Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971. When an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Today's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host today, Dave Allen. Melody may be joining us at some point. She's taking care of other client business as we speak. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 375-4188. For the next hour, I'll at least, maybe Melody too, will be bringing you our opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day for Tuesday, February 13, 2024. Happy Valentine's Day Eve. In fact, so many celebrations today, so little time. Today's a day to commemorate pancakes, cheddar cheese, tortellini, Polish Pox Key, and the great Pennsylvania Dutch Fastnacht. It's also Fat Tuesday. Fat Tuesday is the intertwining of a period of festivals and feasts that lead to a time of fasting and reflection, also known as Shrove Tuesday, and more famously, the beginning of Mardi Gras. This enduring celebration has many traditions and deep roots all around the world. Mardi Gras, which is French for Fat Tuesday, dates back to an ancient Roman festival honoring the deities Lupercalia and Saturnalia. When Christians arrived in Rome, they incorporated the festival into their Lenten preparations. For centuries since, this solemn feast prepared Christians for the season of Lent and used up valuable meat and supplies they'd be abstaining from in the days to come. Fat Tuesday celebrated all around the world in its various forms today, all of which harken back to these roots of spring festivals and religious fasting in preparation for the Christian holy day of Easter. Whatever your beliefs, today is certainly a day to celebrate. Let's get started with today's eye-opening market report. In the precious metal markets, gold having a tough day. All assets seen today, virtually all assets having a tough day on the government's CPI report, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. Gold, though, down $27 and change today. 1,993 an ounce. Silver down, gosh, almost 3% to $22.11. Platinum down 2%, $882. And palladium down 3.75% to close at $891. It's all on a increasing dollar index today, up roughly 0.71 points to 104.88. In other commodities, domestic West Texas Intermediate crude oil up another percent plus, close to a dollar a barrel, to close at $77.78. Natural gas continuing its profound slide over the past several months, down another 5%+ today, now at $1.67 a cubic foot. Pretty amazing. Treasuries on the CPI news all increased today at virtually, well, no, at all maturities, in fact. The bellwether 10-year yield up 0.14 points to yield 4.31%. The 5-year yield, actually the same now, 4.31, but the 2 years still showing a yield curve inversion. That's at 4.65%. And in the equities, really, except for Japan and Shanghai, a down day across most of the world. In the U.S., the Dow Jones down right now a whopping, looks like 525 points, roughly, to close at $38,273, it rounds to. It's down a percent and a third. NASDAQ down closer to 2%, 287 points. 15,656, and the S&P 500 down a percent in the third, 69 points at $4,953. And let's see, anything else noteworthy to talk about there? I don't think so. So that will call it a day. Today's DGS Coins Market Report brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Sorry about that. Had to make a few adjustments here to my microphone. We're back. As I mentioned at the top, it's CPI day, and you only have to look at the precious metal and stock markets and the treasury markets to know what happened. Inflation rose more than expected last month as stubbornly high shelter prices weighed on consumers. Labor Department report this morning, the consumer price index increased 0.3% over January and 3.1% on a 12-month basis. Now, that's down from 3.4% in December, but this is the reason for the big move in the markets today. It was above economists' consensus estimate of 2.9%, excluding volatile food and energy prices. The so-called core CPI rose 0.4 in January and was up 3.9% from a year ago. That's unchanged from December. Now, shelter prices, which make up about a third of the CPI's weighting, accounted for a lot of the rise, the majority of it, climbing 0.6% on the month, contributing more than 2/3 of the headline increase. In fact, on a 12-month basis, shelter rose 6%. Food prices also moved higher as well, up 0.4% on the month. Energy helped offset some of the increase, down almost 1%, due largely to a 3.3% slide in gasoline prices. With the rise in prices, inflation-adjusted hourly earnings increased 0.3% for the month. However, adjusted for the decline in the average work week, real weekly earnings actually fell by 0.3%. They rose 1.4% from a year ago. Bright MLS's chief economist, Lisa Sturtevant, says inflation's generally moving in the right direction, but it's important to remember that a lower inflation rate doesn't mean that prices of most things are falling. Rather, it simply means that prices are rising more slowly. Consumers, she adds, are still feeling the pinch of higher prices for the things they buy most often. Now, the CPI report comes as Federal Reserve officials look to set the proper balance for monetary policy this year. Initially, in fact, just late December, there was a broad consensus that the Fed might actually start cutting rates as soon as its March meeting. That's a tad different now. Virtually everybody thinks that they will not start their easing then. In fact, not that much of a large majority, 50-some percent, see rates starting to cut in May. Fed officials seem to be suggesting in their comments that it could even come later. In any event, though financial markets have been looking for aggressive interest rate cuts, policymakers on the Fed have been more cautious in their public statements, focusing on the need to let the data be their guide rather than any preset expectations from investors and consumers. Fed officials expect inflation to recede back to their 2% target rate in large part because they think shelter prices will fall through the rest of this year. January's increase could be problematic for a Fed, though, looking to take its foot off the brake for monetary policy that's at its tightest in more than 20 years. Now, outside of the jump in shelter costs, the rest of the inflation picture was a mixed bag. Used vehicle prices declined 3.4%. Clothing, apparel costs fell 0.7%, and medical commodities declined 0.6%. Electricity costs rose 1.2%. Airline fares increased 1.4%. At the grocery store, ham prices fell about 3.1%, while eggs jumped another 3.4%. Well, interest rate cuts, now expected to happen no sooner than May, as I mentioned, won't solve the housing affordability crisis. In fact, some believe that prices may continue to rise when rates start to come down. High mortgage rates have pushed up the cost of financing a home and limited the supply. I mean, some lawmakers are even urging Fed Chair Jerome Powell to lower rates to improve housing affordability. It's not as simple as that, unfortunately. For one thing, many regions of the U.S. still have a housing shortage, which was amplified during the pandemic. This is the least affordable housing market for first-time homebuyers in over four decades. In fact, the monthly cost of a typical mortgage for a house rose to 40% of a buyer's household income last year, the highest rate since the 1980s. And that literally crashed demand from first-time buyers. Lenders like to see that closer to the 30% range. Mortgage rates have come down from their big highs last year, but the 30-year briefly touched 7% last week and is now an average of 6.64%. Is still pretty high. At that rate, the typical monthly payment on a medium home these days is about $2,600. That's according to Redfin. Back in 2021, it was below $1,700. That's a $900 difference. That's pretty whopping. But rates, of course, are only part of the story. There are also home prices. And even with rates at historically high levels, prices are still rising. The median home sale price is around $361,000 across the nation. That's up 5% from a year ago. So what exactly happens to prices as mortgage rates head down? Will they stay around where they are now or shoot up even more in the face of increased demand? Well, we recall that housing market of 2021. Rates were at rock bottom levels in the low threes and even lower. Multiple bidders for homes pushed prices up by double-digit percentages. It's all about supply. If rates come down, then supply would come up, presumably, right? I mean, remember, many homeowners aren't selling these days because they don't want to lose their 3% mortgage rates. Daryl Fairweather, who's Redfin's chief economist, says any drop in mortgage rates would help loosen up the housing market. It would encourage people who are homeowners, to sell and buy again. But with supply and demand both shooting up in equal amounts, prices would remain high, he believes. Now, in less supply-constrained markets where new construction is actually happening, homebuyers will benefit from falling rates because prices are more likely to fall. Still, sellers who don't need to sell aren't going to be eager to make the big price cuts. And as long as the jobless rate stays low, there probably won't be a ton of desperate sellers either. Bottom line, mortgage rates are just one of the many issues keeping homes out of reach for first-time home buyers and those looking to move up. Lowering rates could help some, but maybe not as much as we'd like to think. Well, the fight is on in Congress. Earlier today, the U.S. Senate approved a $95 billion aid package providing funds for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and others, but its future remains uncertain amid intense lawmaker opposition in the House, primarily Republicans. The package includes $61 billion for Ukraine, $14 billion for Israel, and about $5 billion to support partners in the Indo-Pacific, including Taiwan, along with various humanitarian aid. A lot of that, I believe, is geared toward Palestinians living in Gaza. Now, the bill passed by a strong 70-29, with two Democratic senators voting against the measure, alongside independent Bernie Sanders. 17 Republicans crossed over to vote for the bill. Now, the bill still has to be approved by the Republican-led House of Representatives before heading to the White House to be signed by the president. It faces stringent opposition there from many in the GOP who have pushed for the inclusion of funding for domestic security on the southern border. Yesterday, in fact, House Speaker Mike Johnson said that the latest version of the bill had failed to meet those demands despite immigration language previously negotiated by Republicans being the most restrictive in a generation. And it's causing a lot of continuing infighting among the GOP in particular. It's just that Donald Trump has said he doesn't want to give President Biden a policy victory ahead of November's election. Well, Biden and his top officials have stressed that approving funds is crucial to uphold our country's international obligations and to protect domestic security. Ukraine President Vladimir Zelensky thanked Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell, and all the senators who backed the bill. He said, "For us in Ukraine, continued U.S. assistance helps us to save human lives from Russian terror. It means that life will continue in our cities and will triumph over war." Schumer added, with the passage of this national security bill, as he characterized it, the Senate is sending a clear bipartisan message of resolve to our allies in NATO. And quickly here, before this first segment winds down, the European Union is looking to sanction Chinese firms that it believes have helped Russia circumvent Western sanctions and related penalties. Member nations are looking to slap measures against these mainland China businesses for the first time since the war began. Well, I hear the music. It means we're heading into our first break. I do hope you'll stick around because you're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody taking care of other client business as we speak. As I mentioned right before the break, 27-member EU is working on a 13th package of sanctions in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which they say could be ready later this month to mark the second-year anniversary of the war. Now, one official said that the 27 EU ambassadors will discuss the proposal at a meeting tomorrow. Now, the comments come after a report said the sanctions proposal includes three companies based in China. European officials have previously underlined the close relationship between Moscow and Beijing. Last month, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said at the World Economic Forum in Davos that Russia's failure is also economic. Quote, sanctions have decoupled its economy from modern technology and innovation. Russia is now dependent on China, end quote. Now, data from China's General Administration of Customs released in January showed that China's trade relationship with Russia hit a new record high of $240 billion in 2023. The figure showed increases in Russia's purchases of Chinese cars and smartphones. Previous reports said Russia is still obtaining Western technology despite ongoing sanctions from the U.S. and primarily European countries. China, Hong Kong, Turkey, and the UAE have been increasingly important in funneling critical components to Russia from Western companies, according to this research. Well, as I mentioned, it's Valentine's Day Eve, and consumers planning to purchase chocolates for their loved ones for tomorrow just might find themselves struck with sticker shock. Surprise, surprise. And it's not just due to inflation. The price of cocoa, which has been on the rise due to crop damage in West Africa, surged to an all-time high last week. And ongoing shortages are putting a squeeze on chocolate manufacturers, who are in turn passing price hikes on to their customers. World cocoa prices, in fact, hit a fresh record high for the ninth straight day last Friday, and that's beginning to spark panic that the supply shortages could become prolonged. After a double whammy of extreme weather and disease battered cocoa plants in the top producing West Africa region. Now, benchmark ICE London cocoa futures hit a record 4,916 pounds per metric ton on Friday before closing up 2.1% at 47.57 pounds a ton. Prices have more than doubled since the start of 2023. In New York, benchmark ICE cocoa futures hit a new high of $6,030 a ton on Friday, closing up 1.4% to $5,888 a ton. Again, that's nearly double since the start of last year. A Reuters cocoa poll earlier this month forecast a global deficit of 375,000 tons. In the 23-24 season, more than double that indicated in the previous poll in August, and marking a third consecutive deficit for the market. The surge in prices is filtering through to retail shelves now, with Hershey's expecting to see a further slowdown in demand for its products from cash-conscious customers after its sales volume slid 6.6% in the fourth quarter last year. The chocolate giant saw its share price fall 30%, in fact, from its May 2023 peak, and said last week that it expects the higher cocoa prices to limit its earnings growth this year. Volumes at its rival Cadbury maker Mondelez also fell last quarter. Now, Jim Rohmer, who's meteorologist and a commodity trading advisor at Best Weather, said going back 47 years, almost every major price blip was followed by a massive 20 to 50% price break within 1 to 2 years. He asks, is this situation different? Well, according to his sources in the cocoa bush of West Africa, the answer is yes. At least for now, a squeeze situation may well continue for another month or two. As they say, the proof is in the pudding. I'm sad to say that I paid over $60 this year for a dozen chocolate-covered strawberries that I sent my wife for Valentine's Day tomorrow. Hope she doesn't look at my debit card statement. Well, here's one that I hope gets your ire up as it did mine. And we thank again Pam and Russ Martins and their newsletter Wall Street on Parade today. They remind us that the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission of a decade and a half ago found that derivatives, financial derivatives, played a major role in the financial crash of that period, the Great Recession, certainly the country's worst financial crisis since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And since then, Americans believe that the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation of 2010 would rein in concentrated risks like derivatives. Well, as the Martins point out, it didn't. They say, according to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the regulator of national banks, as of March 31, 2009, five bank holding companies held over $2.775 trillion in notational amount or face amount of derivatives. At that time, according to the FDIC, there were 8,200-plus federally insured commercial banks and savings associations in the U.S., but just five bank holding companies held 95% of all derivatives at all U.S. banks. The usual suspects, you might say, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs Group, Morgan Stanley, and Citigroup. Well, fast forward to the most recent OCC report, which finds as of September 30th last year that those same five bank holding companies held $223 trillion of $268 trillion in derivatives held by just the now 4,600 U.S. banks. That comes out to 83%. That is extraordinarily high still. Equally alarming, the Martins say, those same five holding bank companies control 96% of the most dangerous form of derivatives, credit derivatives. The five bank holding companies account for $5.8 trillion in credit derivatives versus the $6 trillion in total credit derivatives for all banks in the country. They remind us that the Fed secretly funneled $16 trillion in cumulative loans at below market interest rates to prop up the Wall Street casino banks from December 2007 through June of 2010. That was in no small part, they say, because of the systemic contagion that spread from their concentrated positions in derivatives. Well, to prevent a replay of too big to fail Wall Street banks blowing themselves up again and looking for a taxpayer bailout, banking regulators last summer released a proposal that would impose higher capital rules on just 37 of the largest U.S. banks, those with, I believe, over $100 billion in assets. Those new capital rules, as we've talked about in this program, would impact just those banks significantly engaged in derivatives and other high-risk trading strategies. Of course, the backlash has been fierce, the Martins point out, from Wall Street's banks, the mega banks, the too big to fails, with the banks even running TV ads painting a bogus and distorted picture of what the capital increases would do. As the Martins tell us, Wall Street has a history of blowing things up with their precious derivatives. At the time of Lehman Brothers bankruptcy in September 2008, Lehman had more than 900,000 derivatives contracts outstanding, and it used the largest banks on Wall Street as its counterparties to many of these trades. Lehman had more than 53,000 derivative contracts with J.P. Morgan Chase, more than 40,000 with Morgan Stanley, over 24,000 with Citigroup, Citibank, over 23,000 with Bank of America, and almost 19,000 with Goldman Sachs. Look, enough said, except this. Please, please, please tell your U.S. representatives and senators to demand that banking regulators hold firm on the stronger capital rules for these casino banks on Wall Street. Well, for just the third time since 1995, more than a fifth of economists surveyed by the National Association of Business Economics think that monetary policy is too restrictive. Surprised by that. Yes, 21% of economists polled think the Fed should go ahead and start cutting interest rates, easing up on its determination to sandbag the economy until inflation comes down. It's not that many of them think inflation is going to quickly sink beneath the Fed's 2% target. In fact, the majority of them don't even think it will go below 2.5% through the end of this year. But there's a growing anxiety that the Fed will hold rates too high for too long and finally manage to wreck the economy through an overly narrow focus on prices. One twist here is that in 2010, the Fed had already dropped interest rates to near zero in the wake of the Great Recession. And at that point, the Fed could only have sent them negative, like central banks in Europe and Japan. But the specter of charging banks to park their excess funds with the government, who could then have started charging struggling customers to deposit their cash, proved a tad too much. Instead, the Fed reopened its so-called quantitative easing program, offering up treasury debt, mortgage-backed securities to stimulate the economy. These days, corporate America is looking at the opposite. Interest rates are at two-decade highs, and the Fed's trying to slow down economic growth instead of speeding it up. Well, the Fed seems to view most of the risk being on the upside these days. So Jerome Powell and company have been more than happy to stand pat for the last several meetings as the economy rumbles on relatively undisturbed by their interference. We'll just have to wait and see where all this leads as the year moves on and more economic data come to the front of the line. Hey, an interesting, not necessarily sure it's a debate, but certainly a question that's being asked in the auto industry, much like sports fans' heart rates during Sunday night's conclusion of the Super Bowl. Used electric vehicle prices are all over the place, and it doesn't look like that will change anytime soon. Analysts tell Automotive News, an industry publication, that used electric vehicle prices will continue to fluctuate, and that it's up to automakers to launch affordable EVs before the current ones hit the used market. Used EVs have always been a bit more expensive than their internal combustion-powered counterparts, pretty much across all types of vehicle segments. Average cost of a premium used EV was $43,700 last year, over $3,200 more than a comparable gas vehicle, according to Auto News. However, used EV prices fell 30%. On average last year, and a lot of that was apparently due to price adjustments for new EVs. Analysts are suggesting that as new EV prices and government incentives become available, the price of used EVs will continue to drop real quickly and perhaps resulting in more people buying them down the road. Used EVs only make up a tiny percentage of the overall used car market, though. Franchise dealerships sold a reported just 180,000 used EVs last year, counting for less than 1% of the total used vehicle retail market. New EV prices, which fluctuated significantly last year, quickly impact used EV prices, with Tesla driving the trend, slashing their prices to bring models more in line with comparable ICE internal combustion vehicles. Well, here's an interesting report in our post-pandemic days. New reports suggest that employees, parents, and students are trying to figure out the new norms for taking a sick day. Fully remote work raised the bar for how sick you ought to be to take time off. Because employees were already working from home, they often kept working through at least mild symptoms. But now the Wall Street Journal reports some workers are still trying to push through, even though they're back in their office. And that's creating tension between employees who are worried about taking sick days and coworkers who don't want to get sick. During the pandemic, students were in most places were told for a long time not to come to class if they thought they might be sick. That assumed that they even had in-person classes. But as schools struggle to overcome pandemic-era learning loss, those rules are changing, too. Kathleen Quinn Votaw, who's a recruiting and retention expert, says, if we care about our employees and we care about our students and their health, then they shouldn't be showing up sick. And we, as either business leaders or academic leaders, she continued, need to find a way to close that gap when someone has to decide for their health and others to stay home. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the new or the evolving new normal isn't the same as the old one. And last, this segment, war is expensive in many, many ways. And for Israel, the multi-billion-dollar bill is coming due. Israel's financial strength has long been a matter of national pride there. Now its need to fund the war in Gaza has resulted in the country's first ever credit downgrade. Given the cost of the war in Gaza, Israel will now need to borrow about $58 billion this year, about $23,000 per household. That's over three times the size of the budget deficit in 2022. And on Friday, Moody's downgraded Israel's credit rating by a single notch from A1 to A2, citing the country's deteriorating finances and a conflict that would weaken its executive and legislative institutions. All right, the Moody Blues are telling us it's time to make another break. Please stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, one more time. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. For all your precious metal needs, 1-800-375-4188 or dgscoins.com. Hey, I acknowledge that a number of our listeners are opposed to using any more taxpayer dollars to fund Ukraine's continuing defense against Russia's brutal incursion. And in an ideal world where Ukraine was on solid financial and military ground, I might be somewhat more sympathetic to that perspective. But Ukraine is virtually broke thanks to Putin's catastrophic bombing of thousands of homes, businesses, and other structures, and citizens since its invasion 2 years ago. As of late January, the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine has recorded an estimated 29,300 civilian casualties in Ukraine, 10,200 killed, and 19,000 injured since Russia's invasion. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, however, has said that the actual figures are no doubt considerably higher. U.S. officials said recently the total number of Ukrainian-Russian troops killed or wounded since the war began is over 500,000. You may respond to Ukraine going broke by saying, well, so are the U.S. and many of the European nations providing funding thus far. So why is it our responsibility to fund another war that's almost 5,000 miles away? And look, that's a valid question, but one that's best saved for another program. However you may feel about this, it's safe to say that Ukraine has made it this far in its defense only because of the $350 billion worth of aid from the U.S. and other Western nations. Individual countries around the world have committed nearly $100 billion in direct military assistance to Ukraine. Nearly half of that is from the U.S., according to data from the Kiel Institute from the World Economy, through July 2023. That's part of a total $113 billion aid budget for both defense and civilian needs, though not all of it goes directly to the Ukrainian government. Some of those funds are designated to reimburse the U.S. military for its previous donations of weaponry and ammunition and to help other countries impacted by the mass migration of Ukrainians to their nations. Now, some of the highest cost military donations include anti-aircraft and anti-ship missiles, weapon locating radar systems, mine clearing ships and patrol boats, helicopters, and multiple launch rocket systems. But unlike some of our smaller Western allies, U.S. contributions account for only 0.3% of our GDP. Norway and the Baltic states bordering Russia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia are committing a greater proportion of their wealth to the war at more than 1% of their GDP. Poland has received the second largest number of Ukrainian refugees, around 960,000 in allied countries after Germany, nearly 1.1 million, according to the UN, as of last September. Russia itself has also taken in nearly 1.3 million refugees. So when factoring refugee costs into GDP calculations, the burden of Poland's Ukraine aid increases for about 0.7% to over 3% of their GDP, compared to less than 1% for Germany. All this according to the Kiel Institute. The U.S. and 32 other countries have either sent or pledged weapons and military equipment to Ukraine. Several others have offered training and other more indirect assistance. But further U.S. funding for Ukraine has been mired in Washington dysfunction. We know that House Speaker has said as recently as last week that standalone funding aid for Ukraine is dead on arrival. Well, we shall see now that the Senate has passed a $95 billion package. And that comes on top of the EU, which agreed on a new funding deal worth more than $50 billion for Ukraine, $33 billion of it in loans just last week. Those funds had been blocked for a while after Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban had vetoed the deal at a previous summit, but he relented and approved it this time around in exchange for annual reviews of how the funds are spent. You might ask, well, why Belgium? talking about a funding alternative. Belgium's toying with a novel solution to fund Ukrainians' money issues, particularly because further direct aid to the country is problematic here in the U.S. Again, why Belgium? Because it, more specifically, its capital, Brussels, happens to be home to a large portion of the frozen assets because of its role in the clearing system for European financial reserves. In a nutshell, their idea entails Ukraine raising new debt from private sector lenders under Russian using central bank assets that have been frozen by Western sanctions as collateral. Kate Marino equates it to how one's house is collateral for a mortgage or home equity loan, and you know, a lender can assume ownership if the borrower can't repay. The big question is how the West can financially engineer this assurance for would-be lenders. The Belgian plan would likely involve putting sanctioned Russian assets into an escrow-type account with a neutral third party until the invasion is over. How much are we talking about? Well, although the exact amount of frozen assets is difficult to determine, they say, reports from December say at least $300 billion worth of Russian assets have been frozen by war-related sanctions. Total Russian assets, according to the World Bank, include about $300 billion in gold reserves and are total about $600 billion. Under the terms of the proposed escrow, Ukraine could use assets to raise money, likely analysts say, by placing zero-coupon bonds that mature in 30 or 40 years. The escrow account's very existence could provide cover for the U.S. and other European nations to argue they haven't seized anything, since Russia would technically still own the assets. Or the West could look to the International Court of Justice, which could eventually rule that Russia owes Ukraine reparations anyway, which would mean the assets could literally be seized. Under international law, countries' sovereign assets are considered sacrosanct. Thus, a number of Eurozone nations in the G7 favor an alternative, that is, initially tapping the profits and interest earned on the frozen reserves, which is an estimated $3 billion a year. Since reparation rulings can take years, Belgium's debt plan would allow Ukraine to capitalize on expected reparations now. It would cost a lot of money, some say over $100 billion, and that was as of late 2022, to rebuild Ukraine, and that's surely risen substantially since then. My own humble opinion is that members of Congress who oppose using additional U.S. tax dollars to support Ukraine should get out in front of this Belgium plan and start advocating for its approval or a similar version thereof, because Russia cannot be allowed to win this war. Most of all, the West must not appease Putin now or any time in the future. He who must be held accountable for the war criminal he is. Well, Lisa Abramowitz asks in yesterday's Bloomberg Surveillance, when do markets start worrying about inflation again? Her answer? Well, perhaps tomorrow, meaning today, when the latest CPI report is due. Aside from the fact that inflation has been forefront on virtually every American's mind since it peaked at 9.1% 2 summers ago, we have too big to fail HSBC's Max Kettner warning. All we need is a tiny whiff of less dovish data, and I think that would already be enough to send a bit of a pain across all the asset classes. He speaks the truth, as we saw today. Kettner was leading economists' soft landing mantra last year, but is now worried that everything is priced to perfection. Abramowitz believes investors might need to rethink some of their basic assumptions, like the Fed cutting interest rates sooner rather than later. That's especially so if the government's CPI report continues to be higher than estimates. As of late this afternoon, Fed fund future traders see an 85% probability that the Fed will hold rates steady now that the Fed's meeting until the Fed's meeting in early May, when 57% see rate cuts starting. Meanwhile, consumer inflation expectations for the year ahead held steady at 3%. This month, while the reading for 3 years from now fell to 2.4%, a lot closer to the Fed's target. And in fact, that's the closest since March 2020, according to the New York Fed's latest survey of consumer expectations. One notable exception, still worse than ever, Maryland. They note that when we talk about the U.S.'s one labor market, we can still miss important economic trends. Take, for example, the country's lowest headline U3 unemployment rate, which they say is a boon for local workers, but reveals troubles restraining the state economy. On the one hand, the labor market has loosened up as more workers enter the labor force. This labor supply rebound has helped ease inflationary pressures, while lingering demand on the part of businesses has kept the national headline rate low. On the other hand, the government's U6 jobless rate, which includes discouraged job hunters and Americans working part-time who want full-time work, the unemployment picture is much different. In fact, the U6 rate is almost twice the headline rate that politicians and the media love to tout. But I digress. Is Maryland an outlier? Well, just south of the Mason-Dixon line, the headline rate, jobless rate, is hovering at a near record low for a fundamentally different reason. At one point last year, it actually recorded the lowest jobless rate the country had ever seen, 1.6%. Maryland's jobless rate is currently tied with North Dakota as the nation's lowest. But unlike Maryland, North Dakota has long had structurally low unemployment relative to the rest of the nation. Plus, its population is just a fraction of Maryland's. An estimated 784,000 for North Dakota, ranked 48th in population among all states, versus almost 6.2 million for Maryland, which is ranked 19th. That's as of July last year. Well, Maryland's low unemployment rate, they say, is the result of a troubling reality. Thousands of workers left the labor force when the pandemic left and still haven't returned, pushing the state's unemployment rate way down. Kelly Schultz, who's Maryland's former Secretary of Labor and Commerce Department, noted, "People like to brag about low unemployment rates, but the reality is you wonder who's left out there to recruit in your business." Mike O'Halloran, who's the Maryland director of the National Federation of Independent Business, added, "At first, the low unemployment rate sounds great, but the rest of the story is folks just aren't in the labor market like they used to be. In Maryland, there are 3 job openings for every available worker as of November, close to the record and more than double the state's 1.4 level in January before the pandemic began. The upshot? A lot of anecdotes about employers' efforts to recruit and keep staff with better pay and benefits that we've been talking a lot about over the last 2 years. It's certainly good news for job hunters in Maryland, especially as employers are forced to be open-minded about the types of workers they hire." Bill Tompkins, who's the head of an economic development firm in Montgomery County, Maryland, where the jobless rate is among the lowest in the state, says if you want a job, you can get one. Companies are accepting lower skill sets. In some cases, somebody is better than nobody. He argues that the situation puts Maryland at risk of continually sluggish economic growth if that labor shortage persists. He says if companies cannot fill jobs, they can't expand their businesses. And that could have significant political implications. One of Maryland's 2 U.S. Senate seats is up for election in November, thanks to the retirement of incumbent Democratic Senator Ben Cardin. No incumbent means an open election, and with Larry Hogan, former popular Republican governor, running, I think all bets could be off, because looks like he's running against 2 lesser-known Democratic rivals. We shall see. It's certainly shaping up to be an interesting year, ladies and gentlemen, in many, many aspects, politically, economically, culturally, you name it. We'll be talking about it here in Financial Survival. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back Thursday, but she'll join Melody tomorrow along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks as always to our production engineer Todd Waite and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.